beginning with chapter 20, the third cycle of these warnings that he's giving. Now, the first part of it, in the 20th chapter, in verse 1, down through verse 44, in that he is addressing the elders who had come to him to discuss a matter. Now, I think we can determine what was on their mind by what he said. But at any rate, verse 1, it came to pass in the seventh year, in the fifth month, the tenth day of the month, that certain of the elders of Israel came to inquire of Jehovah and sat before him. So these first 44 verses constitute an address to these elders in which it seems that they were asking about establishing some place of worship here in Babylon. Because he tells them what happened when they came into Judea, into Palestine, and did not destroy the high places there. That led them into idolatry. And for them to set up a worship in Babylon would lead also into idolatry. But God had made Jerusalem the only place where he would record his name. That's where the center of worship was always to be. Well, in this, the first verses out of 26 or 7, here he's dealing with a condition that was in Jerusalem at that time, or Judea rather. In Judea at that time, it was all because of idolatry. They had come into the land. They had not kept God's law and his statutes. They had not kept his Sabbaths, which were, as I pointed out last Sunday, a seal between Jehovah and his people. Kind of like a ring as a seal between a husband and a wife. And so they had violated that. So they had broken the covenant, and they worshipped the idols of the land, which Jehovah had specifically forbidden that they should ever do. So all of that led then into an immoral, low standard of life. Now then, God was having to do something about this because of their own condition. Now, so we were down to verse 27. But the one thing I wanted to notice there is he says, I'm going to do all this for my name's sake. This was sort of a new thought here. Back in verse 9, let me look at that. But I wrote for my name's sake that it should not be profaned. Now, if you just remember always that the name stands for all that the individual is. And when God said he wrought for his name's sake, that is for the majesty and the dignity of his own deity, his own godhood. He's the only God. Now then, since God is the only God, only the one God, then to worship these other gods was, of course, to abolish him and to insult him and to blaspheme him in his name. But now then, so what he does is for his name's sake. Then in that same chapter, over in verse 22, nevertheless, I withdrew my hand and wrought for my name's sake, that it should not be profaned in the sight of the nations, in whose sight I brought them forth. Moreover, I swear unto them in the wilderness that I would scatter them among all nations and disperse them through the countries. Now that's in, we should take time, but I'm not going to do it. You should take time to read Deuteronomy 28 and Exodus 26. Those two chapters set forth God's pronunciation of blessings and curses. The blessings, if they obey him and keep his statutes. The curse, if they should violate that. So we ought to read those two chapters, and you'll understand better what God is talking about in Ezekiel with an understanding of those two chapters. But now let me pass on now to 27, where I stopped. Alright, now we get out of 27, son of man, speak unto the house of Israel and say unto them, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, in this moreover have your fathers blasphemed me, in that they have committed a trespass against me. For when I had brought them into the land, that's the land of Egypt under Joshua, the land of Canaan under Joshua, rather the land of Canaan, which I swear to give unto them, then they saw every high hill and every thick tree, and they offered there their sacrifices, and there they presented the provocation of their offering. There also they made their sweet savor, and they poured out their drink offering, that is, under the idols in these high places. Now, the Canaanites, on the hill, they would set up their altar on the high places. I'm sure that indicated they were closer to their gods there than anywhere else. So now, instead of you destroying them, as God commanded that they should, why, they had adopted them as places of worship, as sort of the worship of Jehovah, in those places had degenerated to a level with the worship of the Baals. See, Baal was the chief god of the Canaanites. So, and to where you could see very little difference between the worship of God and the worship of Baal. That was the result of my destroying those high places. And so there they poured out their sacrifices. Then I said unto them, what meaneth a high place whereunto you go? So the name thereof is Bama. That word Bama means high place. The word Ba and Ma. Ba is where you come. Ma is the worship place when you get there. So it's the high place under which you have come, and they offer your sacrifices unto the idols of the nations. Wherefore, say unto the house of Israel, because of that. Now, wherefore? Because you come into the land, you adopted the worship of the Canaanites, which was idolatry, and rejected me. Right? Now, say unto the house of Israel, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, do you pollute yourself after the manner of your fathers, and play ye the harlot after their abominations? And when you offer your gifts, when you make your sons to pass through the fire, do you pollute yourselves with all your idols unto this day? The answer, of course, is yes. And that idea of causing your children to go through the fire was to burn them or offer them in sacrifice unto those gods. Now, the Canaanites did that. Oftentimes, they offered the firstborn unto their God as a burnt sacrifice. Now, there are not a great number of instances where Israel did that. Judah did that. But there are several. King Ahaz did. Manasseh also did. And there were others there that practiced that. Offering. See, that would be, when you offered your child, you were offering the most precious thing that you had unto your God. Well, God forbade that. That was an abomination in here. Just offering them. Sister Ruby Townsend gave me an article there written by someone who appealed, went back and took up the passage where God forbade offering the sacrifices. And this party used that as an argument against God using hell for his children. Well, hell was never formed for God's children. The part you cursed in the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. So hell was always prepared for the wicked, never for God's children. But if an individual chooses to be a son of the devil, then he's going to spend eternity with him. That's what Jesus said there. So let's remember that what God condemned back there was this idolatrous worship here of offering your children in sacrifice either to Jehovah or to an idol. That never entered my God's mind. That was foreign to him to do that. Right? He moves on from that now, the Bama here. You pollute yourself, now go on. And shall I be inquired of by you, O house of Israel? Now remember, these elders have come, and we read in verse 1, they've come to inquire of Jehovah through Ezekiel. Now God says, if you're going to follow the pattern, you're not offering your children all right, but you're following the pattern of your fathers. Now then, what do you come to talk to me about? Obama, a high place? I think that is indicated by a study of this chapter, of what God looked into their heart and saw that they wanted to do was to build a high place here in Babylon. So now, if your fathers accepted those high places of the Canaanites and went into idolatry there, would you be doing it better over here? Would it be an idol to, would it be an altar to me? No. You can't build an altar to me unless I authorize it. And I said that Jerusalem would be a place where I would set my name, and there you would come to worship, and there would be my altar. That was the heart of God. Ariel. Isaiah used the word Ariel. The word Ariel, El is God, and Ariel was the heart of God. So the heart of God was to be in Jerusalem, where his sacrifice were offered. Now as I live, saith the Lord Jehovah, I will not be inquired of by you. And that which cometh into your mind shall not be at all. And you say, we will be as the nations, as the families of the countries, to serve wood and stone. That passage indicates now that what was on their mind was that we set up here an altar over here in Babylon to Jehovah, a high place, a place of worship. Well, God said, you turn out just exactly like your fathers did. You'll finally wind up here off worshiping idols of wood and stone here. So God saw what was in their heart. They didn't come to really find out something from God as to what he wanted done. What they wanted to know, if they could do what they wanted to do. Anytime we come to God with a selfish prayer, this is what I want it this way or that way. We just want to forget it, but God's not going to answer that prayer. A prayer has got to be consistent with his will. Thy will be done, as in heaven, so on earth. Jesus taught the disciples to pray. Jesus taught the disciples to pray. So we must always look to his will. God's will is what we want done. What is his will? I may not know. I may present my prayers to God, and I do. But it's always subject to God's will, which is much higher than my will and my knowledge there, don't you see? I don't always know what is best. God's going to work out of that, I think, what is best for his people, always. Well, all right. Now, he moves on from that then. So what you want to do now, what you, in your mind, I'm not going to do what's in your mind, which apparently from this passage is, what we want is an altar over here where we can worship. It'll develop into idolatry. Well, here's what I want. As I live, saith the Lord Jehovah, surely with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm and with wrath poured out will I be king over you. I'll be your king. You'll worship me. You'll listen to what I want. And when you don't, I'll pour out my judicial wrath. It's not an emotional wrath. It's a judicial wrath. And I don't know of any other word that would fit any better than the translation of the word wrath. And I will bring you out from the peoples. That's the plural. Now, that'd be the heathen peoples. And I will gather you out of the countries where you are scattered with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm and with wrath poured out. All right, so the only safe way always is God's way. Now, that's a hard lesson to learn, class. The only safe way is God's way. And I will bring you into the wilderness of the peoples, plural that. And there will I enter into judgment with you face to face. Right. Now, this wilderness is not going to be a wilderness like the one in Sinai, the Sinaitic wilderness. I brought your people out of Egypt into the wilderness of Sinai as a discipline, a practice of discipline, to discipline them, that I might prepare them to enter Canaan here. Now, this one is going to be not in a wilderness like that. It'll be in a spiritual wilderness. It'll be in a wilderness such as Babylon here, a wilderness of things that pertain to God. And there I will judge you, and you will learn by the discipline that I impose on you, that I am God. And that's really what God wants. This should never have been if the people had obeyed God all along. It should never have been that they had to go through all this, but this is all a result of our rebellion against God. So it is with us sometimes. Chastening is to discipline an individual. A lot of discipline, all the difference in the world between discipline, a chastening, and punishment. I'm convinced that God does not punish a person in this world, this life. What we do, we suffer the consequence of our wrongdoing, or the wrongdoing of others. Punishment is an eternal separation from God. That's the ultimate punishment, according to 2 Thessalonians, and also 2 Peter. Both of these indicate that. And here it's an eternal separation from God. All right, let me move on now. So he moves on now in the next verse here. And now I will judge you in this wilderness of people and judge you face to face, like as I entered into judgment with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt, so will I enter into judgment with you, saith the Lord Jehovah. So here he brought them out, and he judged them when they sinned against him. Now then, you're in another wilderness, but of a different nature. This wilderness is more spiritual and moral. And I'm going to discipline you among the peoples that you may learn that I'm Jehovah. We can learn a lot from Ezekiel about this matter of discipline and of chastening, correction, how to make of us what God wants us to be. And I don't think it's punishment. I think we err when we talk about God, what did I do for God to punish me in this way? I don't think God's punishment. I think it's consequent, always the consequence of somebody's sin. It may not be mine. Some of my suffering may be the consequence of the sins of the father. When I say sin, I mean violation of the law. The violations of the law, the past have been piling up here for decades. Now that we're going to suffer the consequence of it. Now, if we should experience an economic, total economic collapse, would that be in punishment for what we have done? Because our children, the children's children will suffer for it. No, that's the consequence of what man has done, and I suffer the consequence of it. You see, I'm an heir of all the choices that have been made down through the centuries. Now, these all the choices from Adam and since Noah that have been made, I am an heir of the consequences of those choices. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm punished for what they chose. I'm simply suffering the inevitable, unavoidable consequence of it. Now, this is what I believe the Bible teaches on the subject. I don't believe we're punished now. I think punishment comes, who shall suffer punishment, even eternal destruction, from the face of the Lord and the glory of his might. 2 Thessalonians 1, and about 10 to 11 or 12 along there. So that's what punishment is, you see. It's eternal separation from God. But I suffer in this life the consequence of a wrongdoing, or the wrongdoing of others. All right? And if you have a question on that, ask it, because that's maybe kind of a new thought to you. I don't know, but it may not be. And I will cause you to pass under the rod, and I will bring you into the bond of the covenant, and I will purge out from among you the rebels, and then the transgress against me. I will bring them forth out of the land where they sojourn, but they shall not enter into the land of Israel, and you shall know that I am Jehovah. Now, to pass under the rod is a phrase from the shepherd's life. The shepherd would raise a rod here and get the sheep agitated so they run through different ones. Then every tenth one was for Jehovah. Well, that meant that you didn't pick out the bad ones, but the tenth one that goes through was Jehovah. Now, also, you'd use that to pass under the rod to select the deformed and the sick and the injured and separate them from the herd. So it's in that sense that God says this: you pass under the rod, the shepherd's rod. I'm the shepherd. You pass under the rod, I'll separate the rebels, but I'll destroy them before they get to the land of Canaan, get back to Palestine, get back to home. They won't make it. This is what he's saying. So he'll pass under the rod of God's decision, of God's choice, God's judgment, however you want to express it there. And so that's the idea of this passing under the rod here. All right, and now that, and you know, I'm going to ask, for you, O house of Israel, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, go ye, serve every one his idols, and your actor also, if you will not hearken unto me, but my holy name shall you not no more profane with your gifts and with your idols. Now, when he said go serve, that's an irony. All right, if you're going to serve, you've got to go on and serve. In other words, they have a choice. Here's what God wants, and here's what you want. Now, if you want to serve the God, I'm not going to stop you. God never invades the sanctity of the human will. I want you to remember that. I've said it a lot of times, different times in preaching, and I think it's so. God never invades the sanctity of your will. He appeals to it through love, through intelligence, and through what he would like for you to do and be. But over here, the devil's appealing to you through the lust of the flesh, lust of the eye, the pride of life. And here you're sitting up here making a choice. You choose this way or that way. All right, here's God, the object of all true worship. Here's idolatry. I'm telling you what I want here and what I will have to be. You're going to be my people. But if you're going to serve idols, you're going to serve. That'll be your choice. But remember, you suffer the consequence. You warn what that consequence is going to be now. So Ezekiel is just, every time I study Ezekiel, every time I try to teach it, it comes to me more and more to me, because I think one of the most neglected books in the Bible. I doubt if you've ever studied it. Maybe you've tried to read it and wondered what more am I reading here. First time I ever read Ezekiel, I had no more idea what you're talking about then. I've been reading Latin out a bit more. And in fact, of the business, I still have problems with it. It's a difficult book. Difficult book. But a great book. All right, now, but so if you're going to give your gifts, well, that's up to you. For in my holy mountain, here's a clear statement of hope. Here's a restoration of the people from here. They've been scattered. He's going to bring a remnant back. Now, here is one of the clearest statements of hope we've had thus far. We've had several instances, but most have been doom. But two or three times in the midst of the doom, we had a ray of hope there. Now, here's the brightest ray yet. Now, notice. For in my holy mountain, that's Zion, Mount Zion, in the mountain of the height of Israel, saith the Lord Jehovah, there shall all the house of Israel, all of them, serve me in the land. There will I accept them. There will I require your offerings and the first fruits of your oblations with all of your holy things. So it's not here in battle. Don't set up an altar here. Don't set up a high place here. For when I chastened you, passed you through this wilderness of trial and testing, and under the rod, and separated the rebels, and brought back a remnant, these will worship me in my holy mountain. And that's what happened. Under Zerubbabel and Joshua the high priest, according to the book of Nehemiah, while the first group came back, and they built the altar, but they did not finish the temple. Later they finished the temple, and then they began to worship God, and God was with them there again. So he's the chariot, the movable chariot of chapter 1, indicates that God can be with them in Babylon as well as anywhere else. But he's going to be with them. You're not to build an altar here. Jerusalem, the place of my name. Here I'll be with you to oversee and to bring back a remnant. I have you pass under the rod, and I'll bring back a remnant. So this is what God's telling him here. As a sweet savor will I accept you when I bring you out from the peoples and gather you out of the countries wherein you have been scattered. And I will be sanctified in you in the sight of the nations. All right? So this is what God's plan. So all along, He wanted them to stay in the land, but when they became so wicked, he cast them out and cleansed the land and the temple there with fire and left them in the wilderness of Babylon over here, which was a wilderness in one way, modern spiritual wilderness as far as their homeland is concerned. Now then, I'm going to bring back a remnant. Now, keep in mind, and I think I mentioned this the first of our studies, keep in mind the 24th chapter of Jeremiah. Jeremiah's vision there was a vision of the two groups that would go into battle. Here, you remember in the vision, Isaiah, Jeremiah saw two baskets of figs. One basket, good figs, very good. The other one were rotten, terrible, couldn't eat them, they were only fit to be cast out. All right? Now, those were the groups who would come into Babylon. Out of this first group, the good figs, would be of that first group that went in 597. When Ezekiel was carried away with them out of that group, God would bring back the remnant that would come. Now, the rotten ones were the ones that stayed there. He was going to destroy, along with Zedekiah. They'd bring them into Babylon also, those he didn't destroy. So that to me is one of the best keys to what I'm looking for in Ezekiel. Start with Jeremiah 24 there. Then you come on now and watch the development of that. Now, Ezekiel's mission was to take this group that he was carried away with and keep their faith in God, that there might be a remnant to be brought back. Because he kept telling them Jerusalem would be destroyed. They would not be fit for anything, that group that stayed there would destroy. But it was out of this first group that God later brought back his remnant. And that was Ezekiel's task now, was to see that was done. Right, so now he goes on to say here, and you shall know that I am Jehovah when I shall bring you into the land of Israel, in the country which I swear to give unto your fathers. And there shall you remember your ways and all your doings, wherein you have polluted yourselves, and you shall loathe yourselves in your own sight for all your evil that you have committed. And you shall know that I am Jehovah when I have dealt with you for my name's sake. That's about the fourth time, I believe. Third or fourth time you mentioned, for my name's sake. Not according to your evil ways, nor according to your corrupt doings, O ye house of Israel, saith the Lord Jehovah. All right, now this is, I think, an excellent summary of what are these elders coming. I think that ends with the deal with the elders. Now this is to the elder. Now they've come to him, and from what you read in the passage, you get the impression what they wanted to do was to build a high place or some kind of an altar, a place of worship in Babylon. God tells Ezekiel to go back and review here your condition while I brought you in and what you did there and how you went after the idols there. Now then, that's where my name is, at Jerusalem. Now you want to build something over here? No. You're going to stay here, and I've the group now. I'll pass under the rod of my judgment, my choice. I select those that are going to go back, and they go back. Of course, it wasn't a literal thing like that, but it was only God's way of expressing here what are we going to do. And so out of that group now that had come with the first captivity were those that went back under Zerubbabel and Joshua in 536 after Cyrus became the king and conquered Babylon and overthrown the rule of Babylon there. Then he issued a decree that all peoples could go back to their homeland. And so that gave the Jews a chance now to go back. And Cyrus said, I'm sending you back to build a temple that you may pray for me. That is, Cyrus was not a monotheist. He was a polytheist of many gods. So he wanted every one of them to go back and build him a temple and worship and pray for him. And but at any rate, they came back and built the temple, but it was about 20 years later before they got it finished, because in 16 years, they didn't build on it at all. And finally, they did, though. And so that, so now then God had his people back there again. But again, they didn't obey God. As time went on, they drifted away from God, but they never did worship idols again. They were never again idolaters. But they did take up, many of them took up the Greek type of culture and social life and all that. And that's where the Sadducees came from. Out of the Grecian philosophy they accepted later on, and during that mid between the covenants period of time. Or any question of what I've said now? I know it's hard to follow if you haven't studied this before, though. You haven't, it's a little hard, but you have a question, anybody? All right. Now, beginning with verse 45, and this is the second part of this particular two chapters here. And here's an oracle of doom. Now, from that oracle of hope, that's from verse 40 to 44, now that's the clearest word of hope you've had so far. Yes, when you properly tried and tested, then I'm going to take you back and to Jerusalem, where my name is, and I'll be in the midst of you again. All right, but now. Now then, Ezekiel drops back to his word of doom again. What's going to happen before that? Here's the thing about the Jews. They said he's a good teller of stories, a good storyteller. You know, those Jews looked at Ezekiel more as an entertainer than they did. They said in another place that he sings a beautiful song, and it entertains them with his riddles and all that. They never looked at him as a real prophet. They didn't accept him as a real prophet. And that's strange and amazing to us, I know. All right. And the word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face toward the south, and drop thy word toward the south, prophesy against the forest of the field in the south. Now when you see that word south capitalized, that means the Negev. The other word south means the direction. Now, although Babylon was over directly east of Jerusalem, yet at the same time they had to go around and come from the north to come down. They had to go up north and come around the great desert, the Arabian desert. They didn't dare cross that. So they would come down from the south, so they now go clear to the south of Palestine. So the word south there, and the Negev is that portion there between Beersheba and Mount Sinai, a very arid country there. And say to the forest of the south, not big trees or anything like that, but that's in front of the forest here, the people there of the Negev, hear the word of Jehovah. Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, behold, I will kindle a fire in thee, and it shall devour every green tree in thee, and every dry tree. The flaming flame shall not be quenched, and all faces from the south to the north shall be burnt thereby. Now notice this. This is another one of his allegories. Right? Here's a fire. God said, I'm going to set the fire. And he's going to burn everything from the north clear on down in the Negev, which is an arid country anyway, the desert country there. But what he means is, and the dry tree and the green tree, probably the green tree is what few righteous there were there, and the dry tree would be the wicked there. In other words, I'm going to clean the whole thing out. Well, now does that violate our lesson a Sunday or two ago on the 18th chapter? No. No, what he's talking about here, that the righteous may die physically, but he still lives, so far as God's concerned. All the difference in the world, and I think Ezekiel makes that distinction in there. And just like Paul did, said of the widow, that gives us after pleasure, is dead while she lives. So here's a person who's dead while they live, and he can be alive while he's dead. So here's a person who is a living individual among them, may be put to death. And the righteous often suffer in that way. Now, if a bomb were to fall here in Tucson, I don't think God would direct it over yonder and away from any of his people, for we scattered all over the city. So if Tucson were bombed, a lot of the righteous people would die with the wicked people in that. But they still live with God. They're alive in that sense. And that's what God has been talking about, as I said in 18th chapter back there. He shall live, that is, life is more than just breathing, more than the physical life. Life is made up of the true principles of life, living the abundant and the full life. I think that's what we have. I think Ezekiel sees that, and that's what he's talking about. But let me finish, go ahead and finish this. Then said I, now notice here, now God said, I, Jehovah, have kenned it. All flesh shall see it. That'd be the good and the bad. That I, Jehovah, have kenned it, it shall not be quenched. So when that judgment comes, why, no, there's nothing to stop. Plus, I think that's the principle taught all through the Bible. When you come, you find it in the Old Testament, come to the New Testament in Revelation, here you have trumpets, seven trumpets sound. Then after a while you have bowls of wrath poured out. I think the seven trumpets represent partial judgments that serve as warnings to people. I think the trumpets are sounding now. I think the things that are going on in our country are the trumpets sounding of warnings of what's going to come. Now when the bowl of wrath is poured out, that's a judgment in its finality. That's the final judgment upon that particular thing. It's not the final judgment, the end of time. It's the final judgment on that particular social group or whatever it might be, don't you see? So the trumpets warn, bowls of wrath execute. They execute the final judgment of God upon whatever is involved there. So I think that I think it's always been that way. So God first warned his people over and over what would happen if they didn't turn back. They didn't. So now this happened. Now then, all right. Now those Jews that were left in Jerusalem have become so wicked. Now the fire, I'm going to light the fire. The fire will consume the whole of that land. People that are left there. All right, so we move on now. Now in the next chapter here is the interpretation of that allegory. Here's the interpretation of it. And the word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face toward Jerusalem, and prop thy word toward the sanctuaries, and prophesy against the land of Israel, and say to the land of Israel, Thus saith Jehovah, Behold, I am against thee, and will draw forth my sword out of its sheath, and will cut off from thee the righteous and the wicked. That's where we get the idea that the green tree would be the righteous, and the dry tree, the wicked. I'm going to cut them off from what? I'm going to cut them off from that land. I'm going to cut the whole bunch off. I'm going to bring them all out of there. Whether they don't kill and destroy, I may leave a little remnant there. There'll be a very few, but not many. God's going to cut them all off there from Jerusalem. He's going to destroy the city there. All will be involved. Seeing then that I will cut off from thee the righteous and the wicked, therefore, set your face toward Jerusalem up here in verse 2. So keep in mind what he's talking about. So I set my face again, I cut off from me the righteous and the wicked. Therefore shall my sword go forth out of its sheath against all flesh from the south to the north. And all flesh shall know that I, Jehovah, have drawn forth my sword out of its sheath. It shall not return anymore. So now let's get the picture. So you see, what he's talking about is Jerusalem here. So from the north to the south, even down to the Negev, I'm going to destroy it all. But Jerusalem is going to be destroyed and all is going to be cut off from it. Green tree and the dry tree. The righteous and the wicked, all because of Jerusalem. That doesn't mean that the righteous, even though he should die in the siege there. There were a few righteous evidently still there, not many, but that doesn't indicate some. But at any rate, God said, I'm going to cut them all off. So Jerusalem is to be destroyed. That's coming. Now, let me get down to a place where I can stop here in just a moment or two. Right, now, notice, sigh, therefore, thou son of man, with the breaking of thy loins and with bitterness shalt thou sigh before thy eyes. In other words, Ezekiel is to demonstrate you a broken heart. Now, Ezekiel was a tender man and yet a strong, blunt man. He was a combination of the two there. He had a great love for his people, a great love for God and for his homeland and all that. So he was the kind of a man that when God told him what was going to happen, he was going to tell him what would happen, regardless of how it affected anybody. So now then, he says, high in the front of the mat, hit your hips here. In other words, demonstrate before them a feeling here of what's going to take place in Jerusalem. It's going to be a terrible judgment. And I think we've got one of the most terrible pictures in it, the Song of the Sword, which I may not get to this morning, may get to it next Sunday. Let me look a little further now. And he says, sigh before their eyes. And it shall be when they say unto me, wherefore sighest thou? If I shall say, because of the tidings for it coming. And every heart shall melt. And all hands shall be feeble. And every spirit shall faint. And all knees shall be weak as water. Behold, it coming. And it shall be done, saith the Lord Jehovah. So this picture that he just described, here first of all, here's a fire that's going to consume. What is that fire? That fire is the sword of Jehovah. What's that going to do? That's going to completely destroy Jerusalem and cut off everybody from it. Both the righteous and the wicked will be cut off. It'll be completely destroyed. And the fire will extend fill on down into the Negev there, or Nebuchadnezzar extended that. Now Nebuchadnezzar is the one that is to do all of this. And he's going to explain that next in just a moment. But now look at that. Every heart, let me look at that once more. Because of the tidings, for it cometh, and every heart shall melt. And all hands shall be feeble. And every spirit shall faint. And all knees shall be weak as water. Behold, it cometh, and it shall be done, saith the Lord Jehovah. Bleak picture. Over and over, picture of doom. But Jesus Christ pictured the great doom of the wicked in the final judgment and the eternal destiny. So God has warned his people all the way through of what wickedness eventually brings into the life and heart of a person. Brings to total destruction. This next, let me see how much time I have. I don't have time. All right. Now the next one here is what's called the Song of the Sword. It's a very strong picture. Let me just summarize what it is. It's a picture here of you sitting here in Jerusalem. You're looking out the enemy out there close enough. You can see them whetting the sword. You can see them shining it up here, sort of sparkle in the sunlight, and it comes down like lightning there. And here you've got to sit and watch that. And then when that sword comes and falls upon you, it's coming with all the terror that can possibly come with such a destruction as this. So this is what the Song of the Sword is. But I'm going to have to leave it there. We'll start that verse 8 next time. We call that the Song of the Sword. And it's another one of his terrible. And then in the last part of the chapter there, I'll go a little faster next time. Last part of the chapter, he described the coming of Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians. So he tells them he explained the allegory there of the fire that Jehovah said it will be when he brings the Babylonians against Jerusalem to completely destroy it. That's what God did. Then we'll be carried away. The final captivity will have come at that time. Okay, well, we'll stop there.